Peter Burgess, Lumen Limited. Andrew, the number that jumped out at me, going back to my earlier question, was the $4.50. Can you just go around that $4.50 per megawatt hour again? Is that the additional cost that a big grid, say Australia or Victoria or Minnesota, would pay if it had substantial wind energy plugged into it? Or did I misunderstand that?
Yeah, look, thanks for the question. That's pretty much right. What they're saying is that's the all-in regulatory cost of getting 25% retail penetration of wind energy. That's the all-in cost. So in Australia, it's the FCAS cost and those sorts of things. So any additional spinning reserve, which this report shows that there was minimal, frequency raise, frequency lower type arrangements, the sort of things that we would call FCAS would be that all-in cost. This isn't dissimilar to, again, some of the reports that have been done in Australia, which demonstrate that kind of level of penetration. That's around the cost over a period of time that the market would bear. Bearing in mind that as you install more and more, you're not hitting 6,000 megawatts on day one, that's over 10 or 12 years, that's being, I guess, weaved into the market price over a period of time.
And no other subsidies required?
That's just this report focuses on the regulatory costs and what's required from a regulator and a grid to install. Doesn't talk about costs associated with making wind competitive with coal or whatever. No, it's just the regulatory cost.
Yes, introduce yourself, please. Thank you.
John Andrews, RMIT University. You know, obviously an emissions trading scheme that led to increasing prices for conventional energy would be a big incentive for investment in renewables. So I'm just wondering if we had an emissions trading scheme where the cap was progressively reduced over time to the 50 or 60% reduction by 2050, hence giving some certainty as to, or some greater confidence as to what's going to happen to prices of conventional electricity, what effect do you think that would have on the level of investment? So just listening earlier, there was a mention that if we had emissions trading, we'd start slowly, but of course it all depends where you set the cap as to what price will be put on carbon. And wouldn't, from an investment security point of view, don't we really need to know, almost year by year, where the cap is going to be so that really more confident investments could be made? And also the comparison between emissions trading and an actual target for renewables as a policy measure. And do we need both? How do you compare the two?
It's about 12 questions there. Do you want to... Susan, perhaps, and then you.
I think in that cost graph that I showed, you had a line which was the brown coal price at the bottom. So you've got the brown-black energy price. Whatever that is, emissions trading will add an additional incentive for renewables. But you're still going to have a gap, and that gap will come down over time. But you're still going to have that gap, and that's what we're talking about in that sort of secondary policy response, electricity market-specific target. So you're going to get layers of incentives potentially to meet the cost of delivering clean energy. Gary did talk about the soft start, and you're absolutely right when you say the level of the cap is imperative, but from what we're getting out of the NETS and the ETS, NETS, ETS, feedback is that policymakers want the soft start. So the soft start in itself is not going to provide any likely technology changes or outcomes. So for some years, possibly for 20 years, we're going to need a complementary measure, we would predict.
Yeah, just endorsing that and I guess adding to it a little bit is that Roger mentioned a number before of something between $30 and $35 billion in investment in Australia's energy infrastructure over the next 10 years just to keep the lights on. The sorts of technologies that are required to transform, let's say, the coal sector or transform energy are still 15 to 20 years away under anyone's estimation. So we can't allow in that ensuing period to continue to do what we're doing because we're just locking ourselves into an ever worsening carbon footprint. So you need this dual track approach where you're taking the technologies that deliver today, You incentivize them. A lot of these technologies rely on in-country capacity to bring them down their cost curve, as Susan has demonstrated. At the same time, you have emissions trading that gives some level of long-term certainty for the guys who are doing all the R&D that there's going to be a market for them for their product in the future. So the ideal situation is, as Susan's already pointed out, you get a cost convergence. So you have, as net starts to bring the price up, that's being met by falling costs of clean energy technologies on the other way down. So the dual track approach has been pursued overseas quite successfully, and that's what we need here.
And we should also make it absolutely clear that the renewable energy industry is not asking for, you know, two lots of incentives. We want to meet that gap, and if it takes two policy measures to meet that gap, that's what's required.
We'll take it if you give it to us, though.
Andrew, you can't say that. Because we get accused of wanting that, and it's just not true.
No, that's right.
All right, we have got time for perhaps one more question. Yes, sir. Thank you.
Gary Lindsay, what I'm seeing your hair, Susan. I've always wondered why the energy review didn't extend MREC. Mm-hmm. It's very conservative in what it actually did. Why did that happen?
Well, you probably know as much as I do. look, it was an election year, and I think the government had been embroiled in a debate on fuel energy prices the previous year that didn't go all that well for it. And so the political imperative, I think, in that year was to squash speculation about energy price increases in an election year. And I think the renewable energy industry lost the PR war, basically, in the lead-up to the release of the energy white paper. And I think government members balked at the any decision that might be perceived to put up energy prices. That's my view politically. Others will tell you, you know, quite different. The government now takes a great deal of, I'm a former member of that government, and I'm not a critic of that government on most things. But I think when it came to the MREC decision, I think that they just balked because they were frightened of getting into any. And any government does. I mean, Gary represents the South Australian government. He's not going to make any recommendations to his ministers that might see them fall into, you know, problems in electoral cycles either. I mean, it's the nature of government. They're obviously concerned about stable economic management. They're required to be seen as doing that in order to get re-elected. We just think that the costings and the debates overemphasised a negative view on it, you know, against us.
Sounds like you were still running for office somewhere. But the current issue of the Business Council of Sustainable Energy's journal is a fascinating one because it's got several very interesting articles on it, one of them about the Queensland sugar industry and its energy, the demise of its highly promising energy production profile at the time, and that has a different interpretation on the fate of MREC than had, in their view, more to do with certain other tradable commodities I call becoming unnerved by the prospect of others muscling in. But we can discuss that further perhaps over lunch. We should probably at this point wrap up this wonderful panel, not permanently, just for this session. And thank you very much, Susan and Andrew, for giving us a very enlightening picture.